This is Barbara Ridenour, returning with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review, dated August 28, 2015. We'll continue with the obituaries. Kenny Louise M. Cooper, 88, of McAlester, Oklahoma, died Wednesday, August 26, 2015. Services will be at a later date. Robert Dale Hargett, 83, of Decatur, died Tuesday, August 25, 2015. Graveside services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Monday, August 31st, at Keller Cemetery, Lovington, Illinois. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Sunday, August 30th, at Brintlinger and Earl Funeral Home, Decatur, with Masonic rites at 7 p.m. by Stephen Decatur Masonic Lodge, number 979 AF and AM. Memorials may be made to the Shriners Hospitals for Children. Gloria Jean Harrison, 64, of Decatur, died Wednesday, August 26, 2015. Funeral service celebrating her life will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, August 29th, at St. Paul's Lutheran Church, 1 Backrack Court, Decatur. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to service, also in the church. Burial will follow in Macon County Memorial Park in Harristown. In lieu of flowers, please make donations to the family for a trust in her memory. Tanzia Slocum Funeral Service and Care is in charge of arrangements. Monique Lachey Hyde, 26, of Decatur, died Sunday, August 23rd, 2015. Services will be held at were held at 11 p.m. a.m. today, August 28th, at Main Street Church of the Living God, with visitation 1 hour before the service. Burial was in Greenwood Cemetery. Walker Funeral Service is in charge of arrangements. Vernon McCoy, 85, of Mount Auburn, died Thursday, August 20th, 2015, in Mount Auburn. Funeral services were held Thursday, August 27th, at Sutton Memorial Home in Taylorville. Burial was in Mount Auburn Cemetery, Mount Auburn. Visitation was held August 26th. Arrangements were by Sutton Memorial Home in Taylorville. Houghton Robinson Jr. died on Friday, August 21st, 2015. He was 73 years old. Homegoing services will be held on Saturday, August 29th at 11 a.m., and visitation will be 1 hour prior to the service. The family is served by Walker Funeral Service. Julia Lynn Parks Shea, 53, of Decatur, died Wednesday, August 26, 2015. Memorial service will be held at 4 p.m. Sunday, August 30th, at South Shores Christian Church. Visitation will be from 3 to 4 p.m. Sunday at the church before the service. Memorials may be directed to Homeward Bound Pet Shelter. Donna Jean Casey Spinner, 84, of Pena, died Wednesday, August 26, 2015. A funeral mass will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday in St. Patrick Catholic Church, Pena. Visitation will be from 5 to 8 p.m. today at McCracken Dean Funeral Home in Pena. Burial is in Calvary Cemetery, Pena. Memorials may be made to St. Patrick's Catholic Church Renovation Fund. We'll continue now with the opinion page and start with letters to the editor. Banning prostitution is the real crime. Banning things that you don't like has a long history. though not a happy one. Americans have tried banning alcohol, marijuana, pornography, and homosexuality. All of them persisted anyway. So we learned to not only tolerate but allow them. Nowadays, you can have a glass of scotch in a gay bar while looking at porn on your iPad, and the police won't care. In Colorado and Washington, you can walk out and buy weed at a state-licensed dispensary. Prohibition has also been a failure for commercial sex. Finding an erotic massage parlor on the internet is about as hard as finding a pizza place. Websites offer page after page of female and male escorts. 14% of American men admit to patronizing a hooker at least once, which adds up to nearly 17 million customers. An estimated 1 million women in the United States have engaged in prostitution. Faced with this reality, Amnesty International recently endorsed the decriminalization of, quote, sex work. That position has the support of the World Health Organization, Anti-Slavery International, and the Global Alliance Against Trafficking in Women. They grasp that banning prostitution doesn't get rid of it. It merely pushes it underground, where abuses are more likely and harder to detect. As long as it's a crime, says the International Committee on the Rights of Sex Workers in Europe. Quote, sex workers will be at risk of police violence, arrests, rape, blackmail, and deportation, and will be unable to report abuse, end quote. Where their trade is decriminalized, prostitutes can more easily work in settings where conditions are controlled, clients are screened, and health safeguards are obligatory. They don't also don't have to worry about being arrested or blackmailed by police. But Amnesty International's stance brought on a flurry of criticism. A letter signed by feminist activists, clergy, and celebrities accused the group of empowering pimps and upholding gender apartheid. Cindy McCain, chairman of the Human Trafficking Advisory Council at the McCain Institute for International Leadership, called the decision a heartbreaking abandonment of those being sold for sex each and every day. What outrages the critics is the idea that rational adults choose to rent their bodies for erotic gratification. McCain insisted that those who engage in sex work often to do so because they have been marginalized and have limited choices. But the same can be said of people who do any number of unpleasant jobs, from slaughtering chickens to guarding prison inmates. Prostitution may be a terrible way to earn a living, but the women and men who choose it regard their options as even less appealing. Barring them from sex work, by definition, makes them work worse off. Amnesty International's opponents insist that the business relies on the enslavement of women, but that's a rare phenomenon. The George W. Bush administration set up 42 Justice Department task forces and spent some $150 million trying to find women and girls forced into prostitution, reported the Washington Post. Over 7 years, those efforts produced only 148 prosecutions. Time magazine said the data suggests that the majority of people who work in the sex industry do so against their will, a claim that George Washington University sociologist Robert Weitzer, author of the 2012 book Legalizing Prostitution, says is nonsense. There are no representative surveys of sex workers, which would be needed to confirm that the majority or any percentage of sex workers do so against their will. Rutgers University criminologist James Finkenhauser and Ko Lin Chin interviewed 149 Chinese women who went abroad to engage in sex work. None of the women we interviewed said they had been subjected to abduction, force, or coercion, they reported. Many did it to make the kind of money they could never make through other means. Human trafficking has been discovered in various industries around the world, including Manhattan nail salons, but no one thinks they should outlaw manicures. The denunciations of decriminalization come from a strange alliance of feminists who regard all sex workers, including porn stars and strippers, as victims of oppression, and Christians who see them as drenched in depravity. Both exploit the sense that some types of sex are shameful, dangerous, and intolerable, an attitude that long fueled the persecution of gays. But one thing we have learned is that different people have different types of sex for all sorts of reasons that are really no one else's business. Doing it for money is no different. Sorry, this wasn't a letter to the editor. It's a Steve Chapman blog at Blogs Daily, newsblogs.chicagotribune. Now I'll continue with letters to the editor. President Obama can't defy U.S. Constitution. Never mind that President Obama is hiding the details of the Iran deal from the American people. Never mind, and many in Congress oppose it. Obama is trying to ram the Iran deal through by ignoring the treaty-making mandate in the U.S. Constitution. Obama acts as though he can enact it on his own. Our Constitution doesn't recognize executive agreements or deals or treaties made solely between the president and a foreign power. That is not one of the enumerated powers delegated to the president. The delegated power to make treaties defined in the Constitution is very specific about who can exercise that power. It's stated in Article 2, Section 2, Clause 2. Treaties may be made by the president only with the advice and consent of the Senate, provided two-thirds of the senators present concur. By definition, all deals and agreements with foreign countries are treaties. Did you know the Council on Foreign Relations has been on record for years as saying that the treaty clause is the part of the U.S. Constitution they would most like to change? Who are those members? They are rich elitists who want to circumvent our elected representatives and rule over us. That begs the question, is that why Obama is attempting this unconstitutional power grab from Congress? For the record, the president cannot lawfully circumvent the Constitution treaty-making provision by calling the proposed Iran treaty a deal instead of a treaty. The only way to change the Constitution is through the amendment process, and it must be ratified by three-fourths of the states. Signed, Roger Germain, Decatur. Thumbs up, thumbs down. Thumbs up to the Decatur Township Board, which decided recently to tighten some of the rules for those who receive aid from the township. The changes added eligibility requirements and other guidelines that more closely resemble the programs used in many other townships. It took the township board a few months to get the result, but it is an improvement that was sorely needed. Thumbs up to the Day of Action of the United Way of Decatur and Mid-Illinois, which featured more than 660 volunteers giving 2 days and 1,600 hours of community service. The day provided the backdrop for the kickoff of the 2015 United Way campaign. A majority of the volunteers came from the ranks of Millikan University students. Thumbs up to the number of little free libraries springing up around the area and across the nation. These small libraries offer readers a chance to borrow books and to return the favor by placing their own books in the libraries. The trend began locally when Judy Sally planted her first small outdoor library in 2013. Worldwide, there are now more than 25,000 of these little free libraries, far surpassing the group's goal. Thumbs down to litter bugs in general, and specifically to those who dump their trash in Decatur parks. The Decatur Park District spends about $1,000 a week picking up after folks, money and time that could be put to better use. Thumbs up to the kickoff of the prep football season. Although we appreciate all high school activities and the students who participate in them, there is something special about the beginning of the high school football season. Good luck to all of the teams, and let's hope everyone has a fun and safe season. Thumbs up to the University of Illinois for naming the new basketball floor at the State Farm Center Lou Henson Court. The new logo will feature Henson's signature, a pair of wings commemorating his Flying Illini team, and a likeness of the orange coat that Henson sported during his 21 seasons as coach at Illinois. The renovated State Farm Center will reopen for a game on December 2nd against Notre Dame, and a formal ceremony will be held that night to unveil the new court. Thumbs up to the new pickleball courts at the Decatur Park District's Cresthaven Park. Pickleball, which combines elements of tennis, badminton, and table tennis, has been growing in popularity in the Decatur area as well as around the country. The six new courts at Cresthaven will host the Decatur Pickleball Group on Tuesday evenings and Saturday mornings. Here's a Dear Abby that's close to home. Dear Abby, Decatur Woman's Watch, question answered. Dear Abby, a few years ago, my sister-in-law gave me a beautiful watch for Christmas. It became my favorite accessory for any dressy occasion. However, a year ago, her brother and I divorced. I still have the watch and would love to wear it, but I'm not sure if it would be appropriate or if I should give it away. Thanks for your input. Signed, Torn, in Decatur, Illinois. Dear Torn, the watch was given to you with affection, and even if you wear it in your ex-husband's presence, the chances are small that he would realize who it was from. Because you like it, wear it and enjoy it. There is nothing inappropriate about doing so. Let it go. Dear Abby, my sister-in-law quit her job and moved into my in-law's basement 6 years ago. I think there may have been an emotional breakdown having to do with her work. I also think it upsets my mother-in-law to have her adult daughter living this life. Mom isn't willing to ask her to move out or even discuss the situation. This was fine until my sister-in-law told my 10-year-old daughter that she lives with her parents because they need her to take care of them. Nothing could be further from the truth. My in-laws are fine on their own. My concern is that this is sending a bad message to my daughter, and she will think she will need to take care of her father and me in 30 years. I have told my daughter that kids do not need to move it back into with their parents, even if they need help. My question is, should I tell my mother-in-law about it or just drop it? Taken aback in Nevada. Dear Taken Aback, your sister-in-law may have justified her living with her parents in order to save face after having been asked about why she was living in their basement. Because you have dealt with this with your daughter and the subject is a sensitive one with your mother-in-law, my advice is to let it go. Gown etiquette. Dear Abby, can you please help me understand the rule of etiquette when borrowing a wedding dress? The owner was fully aware that the bride intended to alter it. It was obvious that it would need to be made several sizes smaller and shortened. Also, the bride stated clearly that she intended to lower the neckline and remove the sleeves. Everyone seemed happy the gown was being used again after 25 years of being in a box. After the wedding, the dress was professionally cleaned, boxed, and returned to the owner. She is now livid and contends that the dress should have been returned to its original state, just like it was loaned. I'd appreciate your helping this family dispute. How should this work? Signed, Borrowing Trouble in the Midwest. Dear Borrowing Trouble, it is a fact of life that when cloth is excised so a garment can be made several sizes smaller, it cannot be put back to its original condition. If that was the expectation of the owner, it was unrealistic. The bride did the right thing by having the wedding gown professionally cleaned and boxed, and it shouldn't be necessary for her to make any apologies. Now, in state news, state police, transportation don't fully participate in drill. Springfield. Governor Bruce Rauner is confident the state is prepared to deal with a terrorist attack or flu pandemic, even though two key agencies didn't fully participate in a recent emergency training exercise. The drill, conducted August 13 to 14, was overseen by the Illinois Department of Public Health to test the ability of state agencies to receive and distribute medicine and medical equipment during a major emergency. But in response to an inquiry by the Herald and Review Springfield Bureau, the department confirmed that the Illinois State Police did not join in the multi-agency training because its employees were too busy tending to duties at the Illinois State Fair, which was underway during the exercise. The Illinois Department of Transportation, which would help transport supplies during an emergency, also didn't fully participate in the event. DOT spokesman Guy Trigdell said that the agency didn't participate in some preliminary planning and exercises done earlier in the year because workers were dealing with other issues, including an oil train derailment in northwest Illinois and the tornadoes in DeKalb County. Because IDOT didn't fully take part in the planning and early execution leading up to the exercise this month, the department limited our participation in the planning of the exercise in our liaison role with the State Emergency Operations Center, he said. Both agencies are among those grappling with the effects of a budget impasse that has left much of the state government in limbo 8 weeks into the fiscal year. At issue is a simmering disagreement between the Republican governor and Democrats who control the General Assembly over Rauner's push to change state labor laws. A Rauner spokeswoman said that the stalemate is not getting in the way of emergency preparedness. The administration is confident state agencies are capable of handling any emergency situation at this time, and multiple agencies have already assisted citizens this summer across the state because of severe weather, despite the budget impasse, Catherine Kelly said. Public health spokeswoman Melanie Arnold suggested that 100 state and private sector workers who did participate in the drill were able to fill in for the most absent agencies. If one agency is unable to fully carry out its functions, another state agency partner can assume that backup responsibility, Arnold said. Confirmation that the two state agencies played only a limited role in the exercise came after the department issued a news release outlining the two-day event. That official document did not mention the absence of law enforcement personnel or the agency tasked with transporting medicine and equipment during a possible emergency. The exercise is held once every 5 years to determine whether the state is prepared to handle a terrorist attack, flu outbreak, or earthquake severe enough to cause local supplies to run out. The mid-August simulation focused on what might happen if anthrax was released. If supplies designed to protect and treat the public are running low, the state can request what is called the Strategic National Stockpile, which is a national repository of antibiotics, chemical antidotes, and other medical or surgical items. In general, there are three undisclosed predetermined locations in Illinois that will receive medicine and equipment in an emergency, Arnold noted. The object was to receive packages of supplies within 12 hours of a request for federal assistance and break them down to be distributed to locations where medical supplies are needed. Among the agencies involved were the Illinois National Guard, Illinois Emergency Management Agency, local health departments and hospitals, UPS, and the American Red Cross. In a statement issued immediately after the exercise ended, Public Health Chief Nirav Shah said that the exercise allowed the state to identify any gaps in its plan. Preparing requires continual and coordinated efforts between all levels of government, the private sector, non-governmental organizations, and individuals, Shah said. Arnold said the agency is in the process of evaluating the test, and will use the results to update or revise the event in the future. However, she added, the report is not a public document. Now let's go back to the Decatur Tribune Online. News stories. Labor Day drunk driving crackdown begins in Illinois. Drunk driving, especially around holidays such as Labor Day, is one of the deadliest crimes we face in Illinois and the nation as a whole. The Illinois Department of Transportation, IDOT, and Illinois State Police, ISP, are committed to saving lives, and today the agencies announced the kickoff of the Drive Sober or Get Pulled Over enforcement campaign leading up to Labor Day. From today through Labor Day, state police will join more than 250 local police departments and county sheriff's offices to step up enforcement with roadside safety checks and hundreds of additional hours of drunk and drugged driving patrols. In addition, motorists are being warned to buckle their seat belts no matter where they are sitting in a vehicle, especially during the deadly late night hours. As with all of the state's high visibility holiday enforcement campaigns, an important aspect of the Labor Day crackdown is getting the truth out to the public. The truth is that drunk and drugged driving destroys lives every day. Campaigns like this one aim to end the devastation caused by motor vehicle crashes. Progress in recent years is encouraging, but data clearly shows drunk and drug driving remain a devastating problem on Illinois roads, said Jairus Thornley, IDOT's Director of Traffic Safety. Getting the word out about the dangers of drunk and drugged driving is a big part of why we do these holiday enforcement crackdowns. Unfortunately, the facts aren't enough to get the driving public's attention. That's why enforcement is necessary to keep Illinois roads safe as they can be. Illinois has experienced improvements in the past decade with drunk and drug driving fatalities, but impaired drivers still play a role in more than 300 highway deaths and hundreds more serious injuries every year. Labor Day weekend remains one of the busiest travel periods of the year, and we want all motorists to reach their destination safely, said ISP Colonel Mike Zerbonia. ISP troopers and our law enforcement partners will saturate pre-designed areas to strictly enforce DUI laws. Designate a driver before going out this holiday weekend to help ensure everyone makes it home safe, he stressed. According to estimates from the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, 475 traffic crash fatalities involved an alcohol-impaired driver in 2004 in Illinois. That number dropped to a low 278 in 2011. However, 322 drunk driving deaths occurred in Illinois in 2012 and 13. The Labor Day crackdown is part of the Drive Sober or Get Pulled Over and Click It or Ticket programs in Illinois, funded with federal traffic safety dollars and administered by IDOT. New Metro Decatur Black Chamber of Commerce announced. The Illinois State Black Chamber of Commerce has announced the launch of the newly formed Metro Decatur Black Chamber of Commerce, MDBCC. The MDBCC is the sole and exclusive affiliate of both the National and the Illinois State Black Chamber of Commerce's in Macon County. The plan is to be a conduit to creating healthy black businesses and a sustainable community throughout the greater Decatur area. Information regarding the Illinois State Black Chamber of Commerce is available on its website at www.ilbcc.org. That's all we have time for this edition of the Decatur Herald and Review, dated August 28, 2015. This has been Barbara Ridenour. Have a pleasant weekend and great week to follow. I look forward to reading with you again soon.